I'm Nikki Gamer for Dan Roderick's, and this is Midday. If you've ever been called fat, you probably know how emotionally charged that word can be. We're in the midst of an obesity epidemic, with nearly 70% of adult Americans now considered overweight or obese. Through countless media headlines, we know that obesity can lead to a long list of adverse health effects. But what about its effects on our body image and sense of self? The social consequences of obesity can include discrimination in employment, barriers in education, biased attitudes from healthcare professionals, and a stigma that affects personal relationships. A conversation about body image, weight bias, and obesity. Ahead on Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer in for Dan Roderick's. Midday can be heard every Monday through Friday from noon to 2 on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, WYPO Ocean City, and streaming live online at WYPR.org. Dumpy, stumpy, chubby, stocky, fat. There are no shortage of words to describe the overweight among us, who now far outnumber people of a normal size. In fact, we're in the midst of an obesity epidemic. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, nearly 70% of U.S. adults are either overweight or obese, and nearly 20% of U.S. children are obese. And while we hear about it in the news all the time, from First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign to endless headlines of the negative health effects of obesity, what's often missing from these conversations is talk about mental health, specifically about body image and weight bias. According to social scientists, obesity is not only a physical problem, but creates a stigma. And this stigma has emotional, social, and physical health consequences. The social consequences can include discrimination in employment, barriers in education, biased attitudes from healthcare professionals, stereotypes in the media, and problems in personal relationships. So on our show today, we'll be talking about body image, weight bias, and the effects of feeling fat. I want to welcome onto the show first Rebecca Poole. Rebecca Poole is Deputy Director and Senior Research Scientist for Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, and she's been studying the issue of weight bias for about 15 years. Rebecca Poole, welcome to Midday. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by defining some terms. What is body image? Can you just give us that simple definition to start?
Sure. When we talk about body image, this is really how you see yourself or picture yourself in your mind. And it includes what you believe about your own appearance and how you feel about your body.
And what, talk a little bit about negative body image.
Well, body image issues are really very common in our society, especially among girls and women, but also among males. And feeling badly about one's body or physical appearance is called having poor body image. And this has become so common in our society that some researchers describe this as something called the normative discontent, because we live in a society that makes women feel so badly about their bodies.
So we're really talking about a little bit of a gender imbalance here. Can you break down how women might be affected by this more so than men?
Well, the research on this is a little bit mixed, but what we see is that women are vulnerable to much more stringent ideals of female physical attractiveness. And these ideals really emphasize thinness as the value that people are trying to obtain. So when women deviate from this idealistic expectation, they're made to feel badly, to engage in self-blame, to feel that they are lacking in worth because they don't meet these ideals.
I've heard in researching this show, I've heard the term fat phobia used. Can you talk about that and how, you know, what you call weight bias, others call fat phobia?
Well, we're really talking about the same thing. When we talk about fat phobia or weight bias, we're really referring to negative attitudes and stereotypes towards people, often with larger bodies, those who have overweight or obesity. And these stereotypes are widespread. They're views that individuals with larger bodies are lazy, lacking in willpower or discipline, sloppy, gluttonous. These kinds of stereotypes are widespread, but they are rarely challenged in our society, and they often lead to things like prejudice, unfair treatment, and discrimination for those who are targeted.
Now, we've all been on the schoolyard playground and heard the term fat bandied about. Why is this term so loaded, right? And it's so accepted.
Well, the word fat, unfortunately, has come to symbolize many negative connotations in our society. It has become associated with many negative stereotypes. This has been highly perpetuated through the media. So, for example, we know that in children's media, in adult media, whether we're looking at television or film, that fatness has become associated with many of the negative stereotypes that I just mentioned, lazy, lacking in willpower, etc. And when we consider how much media we consume as a culture, those types of associations become ingrained in society. They become automatic, and they're not challenged.
Now, I know the Rudd Center has put out journalistic media guidelines recently. Can you talk about those in relation to this conversation?
Sure. We, in conjunction with several other organizations, put together guidelines for the media in terms of how they report about obesity, whether it's news media and the kinds of language or images that are used, or also with entertainment media. One of the things that we see happening in our research in the news media is that images of individuals who are overweight and obese are very often depicted in very stereotypical and stigmatizing ways. Oftentimes we see pictures of what's kind of called headless stomachs, often showing people disheveled in their appearance with bare abdomens or buttocks, trying to highlight parts of the body that are larger. And these kinds of images that we found occur in the news media also have an impact on public attitudes. And what our research shows is when people see these kinds of images in the news, they are more likely to increase their levels of bias towards individuals with obesity. And so the guidelines that we've developed really try to avoid pejorative and negative images and language to try to remove some of this bias in the media.
Well, what is okay? I know there are people listening who are saying, okay, maybe you're being too PC. A fat person is a fat person. So what is acceptable and what isn't?
Well, you know, when it comes to language, there are a lot of different perspectives on this. And I think that we need to recognize that there are different preferences. And I think, you know, when we look at organizations and medical panels like the Institute of Medicine or the National Institutes of Health, we see now that obesity is actually being classified as a disease. And so rather than labeling people as a disease, we need to use things like people-first language, which describes people as having a condition rather than their identity being that condition. So an example would be, instead of saying the obese man, would be saying a man with obesity or a man who has obesity. So it's using these kinds of changes in language to really shift how we discuss this.
You know, obesity, as I said in the intro, obesity, we're in an epidemic, and there are so many more overweight people in society now than there were, say, 20, 30 years ago, right? But we don't hear conversations about body image. We hear conversations about losing weight and the weight, industrial weight loss complex, so to speak, which rakes in about $60 billion a year. You know, it kind of pulls us all in, but it also must have adverse effects on how we see ourselves.
Well, you know what's interesting is you just brought up the statistics of increasing rates of obesity. And one would think that as obesity rates have increased in our culture, that perhaps tolerance for larger body sizes would change as well, and that bias would decrease, and that people would be more accepting of diverse body types. But actually what we see is the opposite is true, that obesity rates have increased, and so has bias. And I think that there are a number of reasons why body image issues continue to play out, as does weight bias, even in a culture where two-thirds of the population are affected by overweight and obesity. One of these, as I've mentioned already, is that we live in a media-saturated society, and the media is a very common source of messages about appearance and physical attractiveness. The second, though, is that although obesity rates have increased, our sociocultural values of thinness have remained very strong. Being thin has come to symbolize certain values in our culture, oftentimes values like hard work or discipline or desire or ambition. And unfortunately, if someone isn't thin, these associations are often viewed as being absent, that people are lacking in those qualities. So our sociocultural values of thinness have remained very strong. Related to this, societal perceptions about the causes of body weight also play a role here. Our society is very quick to presume that body weight or obesity is simply an issue of personal control and willpower. And people are even quicker to point the finger of blame towards an individual if they have excess weight. And in many ways, the weight loss industry sends the same message, that if you just try the latest diet program or the latest diet book or the latest diet pill, you can have whatever body you want. In reality, there is significant research and science showing that body weight is caused by many complex factors, including biology, genetics, environment. Certainly personal behavior is one factor, but it's not the only one. And if we only focus on that, what we've seen so far is that this is not a very effective or useful approach. It's just not that simple. And too often, oversimplification can reinforce bias. And then finally, you know, we live in a society where weight bias, discrimination, this largely remains legal. So only in one state, in Michigan, and in half a dozen local jurisdictions across the country, is it actually illegal to discriminate on the basis of weight. And so the fact that it remains legal in most places sends the message that this is really a tolerable form of bias.
Yeah, I wanted to go back, and I'm wondering, is there a moment in history where it was more acceptable to be a bigger size? And have we just gone toward this ideal of thinness now? Can you look back in American history to look at the way people's figures were portrayed and we were more accepting?
You know, certainly throughout history, ideals, especially of female physical attractiveness, have shifted. And at what time in history, it was the ideal to have a larger body size, oftentimes because that was a reflection of prosperity and wealth. But what we see really in the past 50 years is the cultural ideals shifting and becoming more and more thin, where thinness for some time is now associated with wealth rather than larger body sizes. And again, I think we can really point to different industries that have emerged so prominently in the past 50 years, whether it's the fashion industry and in more recent decades, the weight loss industry, and also now our multifaceted media, whether it's social media, entertainment media, etc. All of these formats of media are now promoting these thin ideals in a way that we never had before.
How does this idea of thin or body image cut across different cultures? For instance, in the among African Americans, do we still have the same ideal?
Well, certainly there are cultural contexts for different physical attractiveness ideals. When it comes to weight bias, we see that this is an experience that crosses many different racial and ethnic groups, including African Americans. In fact, some of our research has found that, especially among adolescent girls who are African American, who are experiencing weight-based teasing or bullying, that they find this very upsetting, that this is really leading to different emotional consequences. So when we talk about different body image ideals, there may be ideals that lead to larger ideals in certain cultures than others, but we do see evidence of weight bias really across these different contexts.
You were talking about young girls. How does body image and poor body image affect young people, say teenagers, differently than adults?
Well, poor body image is a common risk factor for the development of many different disordered eating patterns and eating disorders like anorexia and bulimia and binge eating disorder. Oftentimes in adolescence, we see a lot of teasing and bullying going on because of body weight. And this has very damaging consequences for emotional health. This leads not only to things like low self-esteem, but to depression, anxiety, even suicidal thoughts and behaviors. For example, we know that when adolescents or youth are being teased about their weight, they have a much higher likelihood, 2 to 3 times more likely to be engaging in suicidal thoughts compared to their same weight peers who are not getting teased. Oftentimes, when it comes to things like weight-based teasing, which can reinforce poor body image, we also see that weight-based teasing can lead to other types of health consequences in addition to emotional functioning. So, for example, many times when adolescents are teased about their weight, they often turn to food as a coping mechanism to soothe that distress. We see them engaging in disordered eating and increased food consumption. We also see them avoiding physical activity, oftentimes because physical activity settings like gym class is where they get teased about their weight the most. And as you might imagine, you know, these kinds of consequences can have a negative impact on physical health and for increased body weight.
Before I let you go, I understand you've looked at employment and obesity, and that thinner employees are more likely to be hired. What have you found in your research when it comes to linking these two things?
Well, there's been considerable research on weight-based discrimination in the employment setting. And what this body of research shows is that employees who have overweight or obesity are really facing discrimination at virtually every stage of the employment cycle, from getting hired to getting fired. They are less likely to be selected for jobs compared to thinner candidates, even when they have identical qualifications, and sometimes even when they have better qualifications. We see evidence of something called an obesity wage penalty, where individuals who are at a higher body weight receive lower salaries, lower wages for the same work being performed as thinner individuals. We see that these employees are more often denied promotions, and they are more likely to be terminated from jobs because of their weight as well. The research on this really is quite considerable. Several decades of science have consistently documented that weight discrimination really is a problem in the workplace. Some of our recent studies have been looking at public attitudes towards laws that could potentially change this. And what we see is substantial support in the American public for laws that would specifically make it illegal to discriminate on the basis of weight in the workplace.
Well, Rebecca Poole, thank you so much for joining us. Rebecca Poole is Deputy Director and Senior Research Scientist for Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks very much.
We have to take our first break here, but when we come back, we'll be welcoming onto the show next psychotherapist Andrew Whalen, founder and executive director of the Columbia-based Body Image Therapy Center. And we'll speak with filmmaker and fat activist Lindsay Averill. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer in for Dan Rodericks, and we're talking about obesity, body image, and weight bias. In a few minutes, we'll be welcoming onto the show Lindsay Averill, a fat activist and a filmmaker who is making a documentary about how the media portrays weight. But at first, I want to spend some time with Andrew Whalen. Andrew Whalen is a psychotherapist, and he's the founder and executive director of the Columbia-based Body Image Therapy Center. He's also out with a new book on this topic called Man Up to Eating Disorders, a memoir and self-help book for men and boys struggling with body image, self-esteem, fat shaming, and eating disorders. Andrew Whalen, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, first off, tell us about your Body Image Therapy Center. What types of issues are your clients dealing with?
People generally come in not because of body image. They come in because of underlying or presenting symptoms, eating disorders, substance abuse, self-harm behaviors. And they often come back and say, you know, my self-esteem started to become negative dating back to early childhood body image disturbance.
And you come at this from a personal angle. You've struggled with negative body image from a young age. So can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Sure. Basically, what started out was emotional eating to self-soothe, something that Rebecca was talking about, and led to around age five. That's when it started, when, you know, family, parents got divorced and all these turns of events. And that led to significant weight gain by the time I was in fifth grade or so, and that's when the bullying started. That basically led to a lot of depression and isolating and self-doubting.
What kind of bullying were we talking about? Because I have a picture in my head about what that looks like, but yeah.
Mostly name calling. One of the things about being sort of the bigger kid, you didn't really get beat up per se, but it was all of the taunting. And, even having your first crushes and then, finding that there's no way, a girl will want to go out with you or hold your hand. So it's, early small stuff, but it builds up over time, just like it does for anybody else.
And talk about this started so young. How did it phase into your teenage years?
From there, I was about 12 years old when my mother, who also had struggled with an eating disorder in her early years, and then body image concerns throughout her lifetime. And so I learned, just as she did, to get on the scale every day and to judge myself based on the scale every morning. And by the time I was 12, she said, let's go to Weight Watchers. And that started off the joy of weight loss for me. It's like, hey, look at this, all this great reception I'm getting every time I lose a pound or 2 pounds. But then what happens when it stops? And you get that look, you get that Weight Watchers look, like, oh, you'll do better next time. And then the next time you don't do better. Oh, well, you better really pick it up. And, all of a sudden you're filled with the original shame and guilt and go back to the self-soothing that you started out with. That was my pattern throughout my teenage years until my senior year, when it really got bad, when I was my heaviest weight, and my father pulled me aside and said, my father, who's a physician, said, I'm really concerned about you and we need to get you to lose weight. So I'm putting you on a medically supervised program that I'll have you come into my office and I'll weigh you every week and we'll make sure you're losing the right amount of weight. So then it was, all right, well, now I really have to put this pedal to the metal and I've got to lose weight. And it became for me an anorexic experience. Compulsive exercise. I joined every sports team just so I could compulsively exercise. I'm restricting, he puts me at 1,200 calories. I'm going to take it down to 500 calories, and it becomes off to the races craziness. And, it was all about pleasing somebody else. Because I had no sense of self-esteem.
Right. So it sounds like it came from your family first.
You know what? The saying is genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. So I was genetically predisposed to have an eating disorder. My mother struggled. My father's sister struggled. My grandfather on my mother's side, he was certainly a binge eater. And my father's mother was a binge eater who turned restrictive and tried to manage her weight by smoking cigarettes. So it was this ongoing generational expectation of you're not supposed to like your body.
And how did you ever vocalize these the self-esteem issues to anybody, or did you kind of keep it to yourself and deal with it on your own?
No, most of what I got was the typical guy response. I lost all this weight being anorexic for a number of months and compulsively exercising. Senior year of high school, I get to my freshman year at College Park, University of Maryland. And a buddy of mine says, dude, if you just lost another 25 pounds, it'd be great.
I've heard that, yeah.
And so you're really not going to talk about, boy, I sure don't like my belly.
When did you, now we're talking about eating disorders, which are very serious and can be deadly. When did you first seek treatment for the eating disorder part of it?
That didn't happen until I was around 30 years old. And at that point, I had been up and down with eating disorder behaviors by compulsive exercise, restriction, binge eating, cycling. And when I finally hit rock bottom, I was actually in graduate school at the time. My son, who was a year old, and with terrible, terrible medical issues, in and out of the hospital, nearly died twice before he was a year old. All I knew to do to self-soothe was rely on my eating disorder behaviors until finally one night it was so clear I had the binge of binges, that rock bottom, and I decided to seek out some help. The problem was, seeking out help, everything that I saw was geared to women.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because when I think of body image and negative body image, I immediately go to it being a female problem.
Well, and one thing that Rebecca said that I kind of disagree with is that, this is more common in women. The latest research that I'm seeing, and I'm on the board of directors for the National Association for Males with Eating Disorders, and we're always collecting the latest data, and it's showing that body image disturbance in adolescence is on par with what it is male to female. And that used to not be the case. 30 years ago, those stats looked more like 80% of girls disliked their body and 40 to 50% of boys did. And now it's about 80, 90% both of them.
But it's not the same, you know, it is different for men in terms of how they see their body. It's not, I just want to be thin.
Correct. Absolutely. And for boys, in particular, where most of this data is coming from, shows that half want to be thinner and half want to be bigger. The torment is often, you know, the bullying and the self-esteem. What is self-esteem? Yeah, that's something that we haven't defined. And that's the sense of your worth and the sense of your self-efficacy. So I can do it and I'm worth it. But most boys are brought up sort of denying their basic understanding of themselves. And, you know, you're told if you have an emotion, you're not allowed to really have that emotion. You have to man up. You have to suck it up, you know, put on your big boy pants and all of these other slang terms that basically says, don't feel, don't cry. And it was exactly what I was taught growing up by my father. While my mother was telling me, you know, it's okay, but I was more inclined to not listen to my mother.
I'm Nikki Gamer, and you're listening to Midday, and we are with Andrew Wallen of the Body Image Center in Columbia, Body Image Therapy Center in Columbia, Maryland, and we are talking about weight bias and body image. What is the gender breakdown among your clients?
What's interesting is it follows what is the national data, that probably 10% are male and 90% are female, which does not surprise me, even though I'm a male treating men. The problem I see for the most part is that it's still much more common to see women talking about body image and women talking about self-esteem in these and body disturbance issues. The books that were available when I first started seeking treatment, there was basically the Adonis Complex, which you know, was okay, and then there was Making Weight, which was you know, good for understanding anorexic behaviors and body image in men. But again, it was two books. And they weren't really personal stories, so I didn't resonate with it.
Right. And we see so often, you know, the funny, big funny guy like Chris Farley. And, you know, there's Chris Christie, which has been harangued for his weight. But it's funny, right? You know, people continue to laugh at him on the late night shows.
Well, who says it's funny? You know, that's really I'm sure that Chris Christie has had a lifetime of body shaming coming from, you know, multiple places, and he's, you know, put on this very thick skin and tough persona and you know, bullies people around. But I think that's just it. I think that's all masking, you know, what has got to be underlying self-destructive, you know, thoughts.
How, if someone comes in and they have a problem, say, like cutting, right, or anorexia, how do you get to the deeper layer to talk about body image? And what type of therapy do you have to do with that person to have them be more accepting of themselves?
First off, whatever they come in with, that's what we're going to talk about. I think the more people tell their stories, particularly guys, you know, I had a gentleman who I wrote about in my book who came in, and his predominant issue was depression and the stress of his life. He had lost his wife during childbirth, and you know, he didn't like his body, but that was not so much the issue as much as, you know, he didn't know how to talk about things. He seemed to almost, I've heard of the term emotional constipation used in describing men. And just getting him to talk about the loss and the grief, and eventually, you know, that led to, you know, his sense of, you know, how he uses food to manage this. And then that led to the body image talk. And then we find out, you know, where did this start? It started back in late elementary school for him, early middle school, where he was teased and bullied because he was using food to self-soothe even back then.
But what type of coping strategies could you tell him?
Well, I use an acronym that I learned from another therapist called CARESS. The acronym starts with CA. So that's communicate alternatively or artistically, for instance. If you don't have the words to describe how you're feeling, well, let's try some other alternative. Let's write it out. Let's draw it out, paint it out. For me, I was a professional musician in Nashville, so I played my guitar and cried it out on guitar strings.
But what sort of questions do you tell them to ask themselves to become more familiar with the image of themselves and more comfortable with it?
Well, I think the misinformation is that we're not trying to get people to say, okay, now here's how you love your body. I think the problem is there's so much energy that they're spending on hating their body and finding that if I could just control that, then maybe the rest of my life will fall into place. If I can get the ideal body, then I'll get the love I want. Then I'll get the promotion that I want. You know, what Rebecca was talking about.
Of course, the weight loss industrial, there's so much messaging.
Yes.
You know, Weight Watchers, Nutrisystem, lose weight, lose weight, lose weight.
Right. And we talk about, but then most guys say, but I got to be healthy. And I say, well, let's define health. You know, health is not just your physical expectation. It's also your emotional and spiritual connections. And I break it down into 8 points of, what is a healthy, balanced life? And we go, it's emotional health, it's physical health, spiritual health, your work or academic life, family, friends, personal development, and then joy and adventure. And if you can have all of those and you get those balanced, how much does that body image really matter? And then even better, this is a great group exercise that I've used, which I'm stealing from Carolyn Costin, who is a well-known therapist and written about this. In a group, I will have one person pretend that they are dead. And they're lying on the ground, their arms are crossed over their chest, and everybody has to eulogize this person. And you start hearing all the different things that these people who have been in this group with this person for, weeks or months at a time, and they say nothing about that person's body. They have everything to say about their joy or their tenderness or their empathy or their intelligence or their humor, the way they gave great hugs, whatever it is.
Right.
And then you take a step back and you say, all right, let's process that. Not a single comment about their body. So that worth did not come from their image. And you start tackling that as much as you can.
Right. That's got to be pretty powerful.
Absolutely.
If you could, we've talked a lot this hour about the media messaging. If you could change something about society when it comes to body image and weight bias, what would it be?
Well, I'm glad you said that. I had a client who the other day came in, and she had just gone home and was rummaging through her attic and found an old Tops coronation ceremony. And that what Tops is taking off pounds sensibly. It's a weight loss program that predates, anything that I remembered. And this is from when she was 7 years old. And this is the message that she was given. It was green construction paper where this was written. So green is the color your face turns when you see someone slim. Green is money saved by eating less food. Green is a weight loss shown in the ink color on your graph. Green is looking down and seeing grass under your feet and not the mound of fat in between. A 7-year-old is getting this message. Oh. If there's one thing that I would change, I would love to see better regulation on when and where we can see diet ads. I'd love to see better regulation on what is available as a product. I think the diet industry could be regulated like the cigarette industry. I'd be pretty happy.
All right, Andrew Wallen, well, stay with us. We have to take another break here, but when we come back, we'll hear from Lindsay Averill, a filmmaker and a, quote, feminist fat activist. Stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Nikki Gamer, in for Dan Rodericks, and we're talking about body image and weight bias. With me in the studio, psychotherapist Andrew Wallen, founder and executive director of the Columbia-based Body Image Therapy Center. He's also out with a new book, Man Up to Eating Disorders, a memoir and self-help book for men and boys struggling with body image, self-esteem, fat shaming, and eating disorders. And I also want to welcome to the show now filmmaker and fat activist Lindsay Averill, whose documentary Fatitude is currently in production. Lindsay Averill, welcome to the Midday Show.
Thanks so much. Great show so far.
I'm so glad to have you on because you just raised $40,000 for this documentary on Kickstarter. So give us a sense of the scope of your film.
Our film basically takes a really strong look at how the fat body is represented in the media and the way that the media treats the fat body. And when I say the media, I mean the news media, film and television, and also print media.
Okay, so I just want to, I've never heard, before I was doing the show, I never realized that there was a fat activist or, you know, when I say the word fat, it kind of sticks in my throat, right? I almost don't want to say it. So, you know, can you just explain who are the fat activists and what's their message?
Well, fat activists have been around for as long as sort of almost any other social justice movement. And I shouldn't say that because social justice movements have been around for hundreds of years. But when we see this sort of rise of social justice in the 60s and 70s, the fat activists appear on the scene at the same time, recognizing that in the culture there is a weight bias, there is a fat prejudice, bringing up terms like fat shame, fat phobia, these kinds of things, that all appear sort of in the 60s and 70s in the United States. And what a fat activist does is we say, basically, it's not fair to mistreat someone because the size or shape of their body.
What?
And we run around arguing for it.
Right. And I want to ask this question to both Andrew and you, and maybe Andrew can start. What about this word fat, right? To some, it's so offensive. What are each of your takes on how it's used? And are there other words that you would find more palatable? Andrew, what is your thought?
You know, it's funny. When I've had patients who say they can't stand, just like you said, to say the word fat, it feels offensive to even think it, let alone say it. And so we talk about what are some other ways you might say it, and they might come up, well, my doctor says I'm obese, but that doesn't feel right, and what I've heard often said is, I live in a bigger body. But one of the things I love about the movement called Health at Every Size is they're just really good at saying, you know what, just own it. I'm fat. So what?
Lindsay, what do you think?
Well, that's sort of where we come from as fat activists, is exactly what Andrew is saying, is that fat is just factual, right? So much like my hair is brown or my eyes are brown or, you know, I wear a size 9 shoe, I live in a fat body. And fat is only negative when we allow the social bias to give it that negative connotation.
I came up...
That said, I get it too, right? My whole life, fat was used to make me feel bad about myself. But when I start to think of all the sort of words that people would use for me, like, you know, chubby or voluptuous or curvy, right? These are all words that are just sort of masking over the idea that my body is fat.
Can you tell us, Andrew shared his story, tell us about your own struggles with body image.
Well, I was on my first diet when I was 6. So, and by that I mean I was actually taken to a nutritionist and put on a diet. And my family did that because they thought they were doing the best thing for me. They believed that if I was fat and went out into the world fat, that I would suffer. And of course, I was already suffering. I was already being teased. I was already, you know, in gym being picked last and being made to feel like, you know, I was a terrible athlete when I'm actually a fairly strong and vital athlete. But I didn't know that because everyone mistreated me. And it took me until I was in my 20s and started exercising sort of privately in my home on my own treadmill to realize that, wait a minute, I actually am really strong and really powerful. And then going out and being like, and I like sports. Why didn't anyone tell me this, right? Because I wasn't capable of knowing it because sports was such a brutal experience, right? It was an experience where I was teased, tortured, where I was never given the right size uniform. Everything felt too tight and too uncomfortable. And then also in my daily life, when I was 16 years old, I was walking down the street. And by the way, I think I weighed around 155 pounds, which is not particularly obese in any way, but I weighed 155 pounds and a car full of teenager boys drove by and they screamed heifer and, you know, other fat slurs at me.
Right.
So, I mean, I lived in this larger body my whole life, whether it was it's larger than that now, right? And I'm much more confident with it, but it's...
You both live in this world of weight, right? You both work and are dealing with fat and this idea of body image. How do you each feel about your own weight at this point? Andrew Wallen, why don't you take that?
Sure. You know, I had a great experience. I'm Jewish, grew up in, you know, fourth generation Jewish Baltimore, you know, and always, I think it's a... You know, body image within the Jewish community is always a major topic and a major issue. I sort of hated going to the swimming pool most of my life. Moved back to Baltimore in 2007, and we went to the Jewish Community Center, and I finally took a look, no longer being in the South, in Nashville, where, you know, we're a very small minority. And you go to the Jewish Community Center, I'm looking at all these bodies, these male bodies, and they're all balding like me. They all got skinny arms and legs like me. They've all got the same great big belly and hairy back and hairy everything else. It was sort of a revelation of, hey, wait a minute, this is genetic? This isn't my fault? And I had already known this from my work and, you know, personal work, you know, getting treatment for an eating disorder and my work as a therapist, but it was really nice to have that confirmation. And you know what? Since then, I've always felt like this is my body. I've got a wonderful wife who loves me dearly. I've got a son who wraps his arms around me and says he loves my big belly. I think nothing could be better than to live in the body I have now.
Lindsay, how about you?
I think I could resonate that exact sentiment, right? So my body is powerful. It's strong. It's beautiful. It's sexy. It carries me through the world and allows me to express my unbelievable vibrance. And it is incredibly loved. I feel blessed.
Let's talk about fatitude, because I understand that there's been some backlash to your film. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. When we initially put our Kickstarter out into the world, we started to get some sort of negative comments that we were expecting, things like, you know, fat people should get off their couches, or fat people should stop eating donuts and exercise, things that were sort of the stigma we were ready to fight against, you know, this sort of stereotyping of the fat person. And then very quickly, that turned into something much more horrifying. A person, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, but a person whose screen name is God Bless Adolf Hitler decided to post our trailer on his YouTube site. He had 5,000 followers. He posted our trailer verbatim. It was called and renamed it as Cakes, the new hit comedy. And I reported it to YouTube for copyright infringement, and they pulled it down. And he contacted me on my Twitter account and told me that, you know, I better revoke the copyright infringement, or he was going to, I think he said, or else. And I kind of giggled at him, like, really, or else what? And, you know, banned him from my Twitter account. And then promptly my telephone in my home started ringing, and they, you know, people were sort of prank calling us. Those prank calls very quickly escalated to conversations about guns. There were recordings from the movie Casino saying, when I get out of jail, I'm going to come kill you.
Right.
What is the fear? That's what I don't understand. Yeah. You know, the fear of somebody normalizing the experience of living in society in the body that you have. Why is that so scary for anybody else?
Right.
Well, beats me.
it's pathological.
I'm wondering whether either of you are hopeful about, well, first of all, Lindsay Averill, what are you hoping to get across in your film, Fatitude? What's your message?
We're hoping to raise consciousness, right? So we are social justice activists. We are academics. We have an incredibly educated background. And what we're hoping to do is say, okay, listen, there is another side. There are people suffering. And we're bringing it to the public in a medium that people are willing to experience, meaning you might not be willing to sit down and, you know, read all these books I have on the experiences that people are having. But if I give you a 90-minute film, I might capture your attention for that 90 minutes and raise your consciousness to the point where you realize that this isn't just about people being pretty. It's about people living happy, healthy lives.
Right. And I'll ask this to Andrew and to you, Lindsay. When you look at, you know, actresses
like, say, Melissa McCarthy, right? She's very much in the public realm at this point. She's very successful. And you see that she's, you know, at the box office as the lead star. Does that make you hopeful?
Well, I mean, I have a very particular answer for that. I think that, first of all, I don't think I've ever done an interview without being asked about her, which points to the idea that Melissa McCarthy is sort of a token person, right? The other thing, too, is that Melissa McCarthy is, she's fantastic. I think she's talented. She's also always a joke, right? She never really plays a romantic lead.
Right.
And furthermore, she is starting a fashion line right now because she spoke to 7 fashion houses, high-end fashion houses, during the Emmys and asked them to make her a dress for the Emmy Awards where she was nominated, and they said no.
Right, I read that.
We're still even, yes, I absolutely am happy to see her on my screen because I think there were decades where you didn't. But in the same breath, it's the beginning of change, and we have to frame it as change, not frame it as a joke, not frame it as a token, but frame it as this woman is unusual and we need to, experience more of this. And even more specifically, there's Melissa McCarthy, and then there's a lot of little zeros, and there's Rebel Wilson. There's a handful of women that we would refer to as fat women, right? And there's a lot of thin women. Where are all the women that look like everyone at my dinner table?
Mm-hmm. Right. Let me turn to Andrew.
Size 2 through 14.
Right.
Let's also talk about the men's perspective. You know, Melissa McCarthy, I think. Yeah, she's still not being portrayed as a woman who is anything but the sort of the lovable goof.
Mm-hmm.
But what about, I think about from the male perspective, we never saw a male lead as a romantic lead for me growing up. I recently, what was it, last year, James Gandolfini. Finally had a lead where it was a romantic lead, and he wasn't portrayed as sort of like, you know, the lovable goof. It was just, you know, he's a big guy, but he's a good man. But they didn't focus on his size. He was just a guy. And no matter what we're talking about, either gender, we've got to sort of just normalize society. And I think exactly what you were saying is, where is the average American? They're not presented. There was a documentary that came out, I think, a year or two ago, Misrepresentation. And they were talking about the media's influence and that you either have the superhero-sized male, and if you think about it, who my son plays with, he's with X-Men, and you know, Wolverine has arms that would be the size of tree trunks, you know, if we made them life-size. These are the expectations. Real people, can we see them at any point?
If you look just as Wolverine as an example, right, if you take a really strong look at Hugh Jackman, between the first time he plays Wolverine and this most recent Wolverine, he's increased his body mass by probably about 30 pounds of muscle, right?
That could very well be.
The pressure to be that superhero is unbelievable in Hollywood.
And this is what, you know, when we self-objectify, we're leading to depression, eating disorders, you know, lower confidence, shame, anxiety, and self-disgust. How are we going to have a society that actually feels motivated to make change?
Right. Well, there's so much to talk here, and hopefully we can come back to this topic. Andrew Whalen has been with us this hour. Andrew Whalen is a psychotherapist and the founder and executive director of the Columbia-based Body Image Therapy Center. He's also the author of Man Up to Eating Disorders, a memoir and self-help book for men and boys struggling with body image, self-esteem, fat shaming, and eating disorders. Andrew Whalen, where can people find your book?
You can find it on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, pretty much any book site where you want to find it. The paperback is on Amazon.
All right. Well, it's been nice having you. Thanks for doing our show. And Lindsay Averill has also been with us. Lindsay Averill is a fat activist and the producer and co-director of Fatitude, a documentary now in production. Lindsay Averill, when can we see your movie?
Probably in the next year, but you can find out more information about us at fatitudethemovie.com.
Excellent. Well, thanks for being on our show today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, that's it for the first hour of Midday. Up next, an encore broadcast of Dan's conversation with David Sachs about food trends. I'm Nikki Gamer. Thanks for joining us.